My name is Michael McCusker. I'd like to read this morning something I actually rewrote and read back in September during our fall pledge drive. But it was about the upcoming century and the new year that we're coming into in just a couple of days. So I thought I'd read it again with a little bit of revision, not much. And with a quote from St. John, "It doth not yet appear what we shall be." Humanity by its own contrivance, and before I finish that thought, I should probably say this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only in the entire universe, and I title it Century 21, The Future is All We Have Left. Humanity, by its own contrivance, has cast itself into a new century, which has few discernible trails into its interior. It is still a vast empty space to be explored, a cosmos of time yet to be filled with presence and experience. Almost all of us alive at its start will not be on the planet at its end, unless life is significantly prolonged, and even then, most likely only a few will benefit. The new century seems as much in a rush as the 20th century that, for all its frenzied acceleration, is the dead past. Our numerical system has made it a vanished time as remote as the Paleolithic, despite its leakage of style and persona into the new century. But that will also lessen to a disappearing trickle. Now it is simply a memory. We are 21st century beings now. The furious century we passed through a decade ago is an impenetrable wall except through its diminishing influence. We lean against the future as if time were a headwind, blowing against us as we charge through. Like deep ocean mariners, we put our faces into the wind and shake, rattle, and roll into infinity. The millennium humanity now penetrates might be more realistically dated back to the middle of the 20th century, the summer of 1945, on the aptly named Day of Trinity, when the first humanly inspired nuclear explosion converted a section of desert into glass. Unlike the bicameral Christian calendar that contrives a parochial split in history, each half falling away from the other, the fissure of atomic energy is the true historical divide. It was one of those rare moments that seemed as if everything before that moment was inexorably directed toward it, and afterward will be measured from it, until some other great cosmic mystery overwhelms our perceptions. At that point, history could have been renumbered. The mushroom cloud was the end of the old calendar, but might finally be recognized a century or more up the line, as was the Christian calendar, first collated centuries after its acclaimed miracle. What we certainly do have at the beginning of the century millennium is human-induced terror and fear. Terrorism inflicted by amateur partisans of various malevolent creeds that often involve suicides, as well as random mass murder. And terrorism committed by established state forces, either in 50-fold retaliation or preemptive terrorism. Terrorism must be considered in the larger sense before it can be stopped. War inevitably kills innocent people, especially in this era when populations are the foremost targets, which makes war itself a major and persistent act of terrorism. In particular, the favored concept of total war that dates back to biblical times and earlier, with entire populations open for annihilation, is not only the prerogative of government and military institutions, but obviously of those who struggle against them with any means at hand, however horrible and catastrophic the results. It is often said that terrorism is the poor man's B-52. And obviously, stratospheric bombers and predator drone missiles, controlled from half a world away, are out of the reach of defenseless people underneath them. And of course, the world is suffering the trauma of economic collapse at the end of this century's first decade, brought on by its foremost financial institutions because of rapacious and irresponsible greed and avarice. Not surprisingly, these same robber barons shamelessly demand rescue by the governments and taxpayers they defrauded, and savagely attack laws to prevent them from doing it again, which gives new credence to the old axiom, socialism for the rich, capitalism for the poor. Nothing is more obsolete than yesterday's visions of tomorrow, someone said. Or as Niels Bohr facetiously remarked, prediction is difficult, especially about the future. Yet hope itself is an attempt to profit by prophecy. A border made on time like grid lines on an ocean chart has been irrevocably crossed, and the human inhabitants of this planet stare into unknown space, aware that the rest of their lives will be spent unraveling the mystery. The essential question is, what will it be like? Prognosticating can be a grisly yet irresistible game. Neo-Nostradamus speculation is questionable because it roots futuristic visions in the subsoil of current status quo. Instead, a century opens up like an unexplored frontier, a clean slate with manifold opportunities of yin and yang, though very soon everyone learns our shadows have followed us through the portal and that, unfortunately, this first decade has possibly set the standard. The most abundant initial projections for this brand new century were cheerful, high-spirited, and starry-eyed. Commercial auguries were especially blissful, biotechnology returning humanity to Eden through the beneficent efforts of megacorporations to recreate a Mac-Disney vision of paradise on Earth. Darker, much more grim prophecies gloom the happy-faced future beamed at us from all of our electronic orifices. This next century might be the ultimate wasteland of wanton human profligacy. Worst-case scenarios for the coming century envision catastrophic possibilities of utter obliteration of planet and life. We might, this century or some other period in the upcoming millennium, lose our oldest and most desperate struggle against microscopic bacteria and viruses. At some vulnerable moment, a bacteria or virus of such intensity and opportunity will surge through humanity before it is able to defend itself. A worldwide pandemic might possibly depopulate entire continents of human life. At the very least, tens of millions could die within days. We might poison ourselves into oblivion. By saturating the planet with such highly toxic materials, we will no longer be able to eat, drink, or breathe without ingesting lethal pollutants we have poured into the land, sky, oceans, and rivers. We now have more chemicals in our bodies that were not there even a century ago. We have altered everything organic inside and outside ourselves. The nature that existed before man no longer exists, Karl Marx said. We might bake like pies in the sun's oven because our industry has torn large, ragged holes in the thin fabric of upper-level ozone that protects us from lethal ultraviolet rays intermixed with life-giving sunlight. The rays screened by ozone are exactly those that are absorbed by DNA and cremate cells. We might deliberately or accidentally eradicate ourselves with lethal viruses or chemicals we created to wipe out entire populations of ourselves. Some of these pathogens are designed to infect everyone but an inoculated few. Others have been produced for which there is no antidote or antivenom. So-called rogue regimes might have nothing to lose by releasing pathogens into water supplies or the atmosphere. They might be used by bioterrorists who shrug away human costs with cavalier indifference. Perhaps suicidal eco-terrorism by fanatically impelled divine inspiration will resolve to eliminate humanity. Or well-meaning extremists who believe the human population needs serious thinning before it irreparably harms Earth. That a smaller population is more friendly, less hostile, and not so hysterically neurotic might be the reason. and philosophy. Or the irresponsible rapaciousness that underlays humanity and fuels the omnipotence of those who would be masters of the planet and galaxy or cosmos might very well destroy the species and planet in the biological equivalent of thermonuclear war in their eternal struggle for supremacy. And of course, we might reactivate the old hobgoblin of nuclear holocaust and blast ourselves out of the universe, as we almost did over a half-century span, developing arsenals so huge that two decades after the Cold War, more than enough nuclear weapons remain stockpiled to blow the planet to smithereens many times over. A real danger rests in reducing armaments to a small enough level that will embolden minor members of the nuclear club to let fly with their weapons, such as India and Pakistan against each other. And nuclear terrorists wait for their opportunity. The axiom, which applies also to chemical biological agents, that what humans invent, they use, should be a sobering anxiety these precarious years ahead. Then again, we might culturally self-destruct through a fabulously modern way of virtuality by cyber war, breaking all of the interconnections with which we are increasingly dependent, eradicating our multicultural, one-world civilization by the very modem that created it. Maybe this century Earth will be hit by a doomsday rocket that might burst from outer space, as was erroneously predicted. We should hope it's an error. A few years ago to knock us off orbit in the year 2028. We might become so neurotic and paranoid about everything we think threatens our well-being and chances for survival in the upcoming century, we will suffer psychological meltdown. Humanity spent the last half of the 20th century in fear of obliteration, mostly of the nuclear sort, and the immense psychological effects are not yet to be measured. Paradoxically, the intense technology of that somber period constructed an electronics milieu greeted as a new dawning of civilization. Aside from dark fears and premonitions projected as the logical and generally dreadful culmination of intrinsically bad habits and calamitous decisions made by powerful and selfish interests perpetuating only their own menacing agendas, there are prospects that seem benign, or at least less negative, such as a growing, though reluctant, acceptance of homosexuality as a natural form of human sexuality as old and endurable as heterosexuality, which is actually becoming a drastic problem overpopulating Earth. Homosexual love might very well be an innate answer to fulfilling sex and intimacy without destroying humanity with insensate, locust-like procreation. More placid possibilities than self-ruin are that we might reconfigure the planet's entire landmass into a stupendous megapolis to habitate our exploding population, possibly 10 billion by 2030 if the doomsday rock doesn't hit us 2 years earlier, and convert the oceans and large lakes into huge hydroponics farms, as well as domesticate and genetically modify varieties of edible fish. We might also domesticate the solar system, if not actually capable of humanating the planets for habitat, certainly mining them for essential minerals and fuels, and we will certainly initiate interplanetary tourism. Electrical, mechanical transplants into the human neural system are being acclaimed as humanity's next great evolution into a superhuman or suprahuman bio-automated organism, perhaps the first of its kind in all creation anywhere. The bionic creator purposely transforms itself out of the biological world. This concomitant with the completed draft of the human genome system and the legal patenting of biological parts and full life forms. Mutant subspecies of humans might very well be fabricated and mass-produced, as well as patented, for this brave new world to do the menial work and drudgery increasingly shunned by natural humanity. A way might be found to keep the world's masses of poor people alive and healthy in exchange for body parts for rich folk. Herds of healthy poor can be made available for organs and limbs for affluent recipients, as well as an abundant food supply once the taboos and antibiotic problems of cannibalism are eradicated. Male humans might become extinct this century as a result of being biologically and socially irrelevant as a result of in vitro fertilization, as well as sperm and embryo storage, the rise of feminism, and the obsolescence of hunting. The cold reality is that women can survive as the lone gender and continue to perpetuate the species, females, as well as do all the other busy work. Men are good for only one thing, really, and are genetically immaterial, except perhaps a few sired as playmates. Life might very well be prolonged in the coming century, but it will create conditions of overcrowding that the peoples of Asia and parts of the Middle East, who have long lived in numberless numbers in their cultures for millennia, might have to teach the rest of the world to learn to live with. Our numbers might paradoxically reduce us once more to a more habitable population by mass starvation and epidemic as a result of the gross escalation of our species. Who will be given the opportunity to live longer lives, and who might be aborted to make room? By the end of the 21st century, the USA and probably most of the rest of the world will be multi-hued, and no nation of the West will be predominantly albino. The US might throw off its final facades of democracy and popular government and reemerge as a full-blown, militant, plutocratic theocracy. Despite the failure of the Bush presidency, the apocalyptic fringe of the Christian evangelical movement persistently campaigns for political dominance, utilizing democratic grassroots techniques as well as a combination of corporate media advertising and pulpit propaganda to gain absolute control of government and citizenry. The first act of the new theolytical state will obviously be to abolish the last vestiges of democracy, which will include labor rights and racial equity. Freedom of religion would be the next casualty, all religions other than the corporate state religion liquidated. After that, edicts banning feminism, homosexuality, and miscegenation to preserve savagely paranoid white male heterosexual supremacy amidst increasing majorities of mixed races and the biological irrelevance of males, particularly white ones. Maybe China will rise as a superior world culture this new century or the next. And perhaps also in the words of Lafcadio Hearn, who predicted at the end of the 19th century that Asia would eventually regain supremacy in world affairs and appropriate the best Western cultures offer and discard what is useless or of little merit, we who prevail for more than half a millennium will be, quote, missed as much as the ichthyosaur, unquote. The Chinese have long recognized the only immutable law is that everything changes. Henry Adams, at the beginning of the 20th century, believed the wave of change was a manifestation of a universal law of acceleration. History was speeding up, which disputably makes morality, as well as technology, relativist. Moral codes developed in one period are rigidly obstructionist in a succeeding era, and are usually diffused by the irresistible dynamics of humanity's swift evolution. The general procedure is periods of acceleration followed by slower periods of reflection and synergization, which fuel newer epochs of accelerated change. Adams thought the electric dynamo made history obsolete, that the experience gained by learning and manipulating the strength of animals, wind, and water was made irrelevant by the rising mechanistic electronics technology that transformed this new history into an era of energy that shows no sign of slowing down as our cyberbotic world recreates itself at speeds close to light. Humanity eternally pushes at the edge of evolution, incessantly, impatiently, and recklessly remaking the natural world into its own image. Homo sapiens sapiens races through spectrums of time we calculate and measure, but little understand, propelled into every moment with impatience and hope, overturning nature as well as our own history, regarding each as irrelevant. And perhaps the only consistency to our history is our disdain of nature, regarding the natural world in which we have spent most of our history as an adversary to be overcome and altered to our design, whether it be domestication of grains and animals, to genetically mutating them and also ourselves, for future suzerainty over the entire planet. Probably nothing can stop or even detour the surge of our species except extinction, either by ourselves or our inability to catch up with an expanding universe. Humanity's rise through complex genetic spiderwebs of primates and hominids, developing wit and organizational skills during 98% of its span that has been spent hunting as a clever and rapacious carnivore. Its subsequent civilizations based on agriculture, commerce, and warfare seems barely a breath in the life of Earth. Yet its short reign has metamorphosed most of the above sea level world to its own pervasive narcissism. Archaeological evidence points to the possibility that Neolithic villages were more appreciative of peace rather than war. Villages generally cooperated with each other. Shortages of one community would be alleviated by trade with another. Neolithic humanity at the dawn of civilization might have come closer to the ideal of peace and harmony through mutual needs and trade than any later community. The end of the Cold War of the 20th century opened the prospect of a full circle of civilization, the realization that peaceful harmony and cooperation is preferable to incessant and reckless competition that most often leads to war. Unfortunately, unlike our Neolithic ancestors, humanity has since developed huge nationalistic military organizations whose purpose is to provoke war and the threat of war as crucial implements of international policy. Communism and socialism, the failed creeds of the last century, for all their brutal flaws, were at least rooted in community and society. Not so capitalism, a word and concept as cold and brittle as a silver coin. The raw excesses of multinational corporate capitalism in its quest to dominate world trade and commerce, especially since the end of the Cold War, are bitterly resisted by a rising turbulence caused by intense pressure from below, the bottom of the resources trickle down, which is concernedly uniting the majority of humanity that struggles for a decent living on this overpopulated planet. This upheaval collates every previous civil rights and working class struggle. The outcome of this titanic conflict might, for reasons of basic survival, readjust the center of power and pioneer the first true, universally human community in its long evolution. It seems likely that women were the real pioneers of the cultivation of grains and domestication of animals that led to the agricultural revolution that produced civilization. The focal priority of this century is to complete the social and personal equality of women. This transcends most other needs because it is the most basic correction for humanity to make, as well as the most potent force to successfully fulfill the myriad other needs. There is also a consequence about the future that has to do with young persons, about their young, undeveloped bodies and minds flowing onward, polluted by the noxious cultures in which they grow, so often twisted and malformed, wondering how many might grok just enough to not only survive but assist the species with overpopulation versus overpollution and massive destruction of the planet's sustenance by the very people it is allowed to rise to positions of destructive force, as well as the paradox of devastation of the very agriculture that created civilization in order to provide habitat for the population explosion, which is the direct reaction of agriculture and the formation of civilization. Star measurer, deviser of great systems. Humanity is still a floundering creature, Lauren Isley wrote halfway through the past century. Deeply written in our bodies is the old world of the ice, the tiger, and the cave, Isley wrote. We have been steeped and ripened in ages of ice and rain. And like most of nature's great innovations, there is an orphan's obscurity about us, he wrote, as we yearn for the lost safety of the old instinctive world we abandoned in our relentless assault on the future. Sir Thomas Browne said the created world is only a small parenthesis in eternity. In that sense, we are little more than cartoon dogs laying on roofs of doghouses, staring up at the stars. Scientists say humanity must escape Earth before the sun explodes. More likely, it might be necessary to leave the sole nest of the home planet before we destroy it and ourselves. We imperil the future when we lose faith in it. We endanger our descendants when we try to hide our evasive lives in the vanished worlds of our ancestors. No single human can avoid death by retreating into a personal past, nor can a society survive through empty homage to a fancied simpler period or more glorious age. Romanticizing the past inhibits the insights that our ancestors and their histories provide and dissolves the strength of will necessary to converge with the future. Despite the probable catastrophes and disasters, it is self-defeating to innately dread the future. After all, it is where we will spend the rest of our lives. Every passing moment is new, like waves from an immense ocean, each second an uncertainty unexplored and doubtful, and as instantly history, irretrievable except in memory and myth. Gravity nails our flesh to earth, yet spins our blood for balance through the spheres of our brains on a perpetual edge of the present. Instants swarm at us like particles and protons, or like locusts flailing against us, wearing us away. We bring to each instant a baggage of tradition and experience, and a worry about death. We grasp the passing moment, impose our past upon it, and reel in the next. And that is something I wrote. Century 21. The future is all we have left. And I'd like to read a poem, Ripening, by John Buckley, who died in 1999. The avenue of by and by leads to the house of nowhere, Cervantes. There is a mind in you, no magic, ever worked that is not your own. The pattern blazoned in your skin disarms even the darkest sorcery. Each night you watch the stars as if you could, by contemplation, find where you began and begin again, improvisations of the future's past. The future in the stars is a changeling, and its true face is no face, whose memory lingers more clearly than the pale hair of your wrist bone. What is it vanishing? It will come not to another, but to itself. The dark beyond the stars come to light, not to discover, but to imagine. You now as you will be then, amid the thistles and the stars. And that was John Buckley, Ripening. Buckley died in 1999. And when I first read Century 21, I dedicated it to my next-door neighbor, who was born that same year that Buckley died, 1999. And she will be 100 in 2099, the last year of this coming century. And this is Michael McCusker wishing you a happy new year.